From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. Today, we devote a full hour to the opening of the National Museum of African American History and Culture.
The time will come when few people remember drinking from a colored water fountain, or boarding a segregated bus, or hearing in person Dr. King's voice boom down from the Lincoln Memorial. And that's why what we build here won't just be an achievement for our time, it will be a monument for all time.
100 years in the making since the museum was first proposed in 1915 by black veterans of the Civil War. They pushed to get that project off the ground. Others said it wasn't necessary. We wanted to know whether you think it's important to have a museum dedicated to African American history and culture. And here are your first thoughts.
My name is Xavier and I'm from the Cascade, Atlanta area. Personally, I think it is because we don't have too many museums just for us. There's a lot of museums that have African American history in it. But it's not just too many that we can go and just have it to ourselves.
We'll share more of your thoughts all throughout the show, and you can send more to us. Leave us a message at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter, at OST Talk, or post to Facebook. And again, we might feature your comments on the show. So reach out and get in touch with us. You know, we've talked a lot on this show about activism and how it has changed this country in recent decades and well into the past. We've heard from early civil rights leaders like Emory University lecturer Kathleen Cleaver. She was one of the organizers of the Black Panther movement.
The 14th Amendment was passed at the end of the Civil War and gave black people the right to vote. In the 60s, we're having a voting rights movement, okay? So America is very slow about recognizing what blacks are entitled to, and particularly in the South, they want to undo and unroll and push back.
We've also heard from a new generation of activists like Atlanta native Ariel Marie of the Black Lives Matter movement.
Jim Crow has just slipped on a new suit. There's so many laws that, and there's so many constructs that mirror exactly what was going on in the 60s. Not only are we battling that, but we're also having to plead and having to prove that there is, in fact, a race issue in America.
The past and the present were featured in the September issue of Smithsonian Magazine. That issue is called Black in America. The magazine's release coincided with the opening of the new National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, D.C. I spoke about the issue with its editor-in-chief, Michael Caruso, and I began by asking him how they chose what to include and what to leave out.
Everybody is very passionate about this subject in all kinds of ways, and so there are lots of arguments about what to put in, what to exclude. There are 35,000 objects in this new museum's collection. So
not all out on the floor at the same time. Some of them are in storage.
No, yeah. A lot are in storage, although they have a dedication to rotate them around so that at least 70 to 80% of all those objects will be on the floor in the coming years. But there are, with 35,000 objects, so many of them that have such poignant and powerful stories behind them. We had a lot of debate within the magazine about what to include, what to photograph, and what to exclude, which was really the most difficult decision.
I bet. Was that final decision left with you? How did you make it?
Well, that's one of the benefits of being the editor-in-chief.
Yeah, and one of the sorrows, I assume.
Absolutely. I mean, it does finally rest with me, so it's my fault what's in there and what's not.
Okay, so you have four different covers for this magazine. I just got my issue at home. I have one cover. It's not the cover that's featured on newsstands, and that cover has been a little bit controversial. It features a guy in a hoodie, and he's holding an ice cream.
Yes.
And there are people that say the Smithsonian shouldn't be getting political. Were you making a political statement with that cover?
No, I don't think so. It's a young man. He is wearing a hoodie, but a lot of young men wear hoodies. And he's holding an ice cream. His T-shirt has superheroes on it. I think it's a very positive and innocent image.
So you told my producers that the article that has really kind of stuck with you is the one on Black Twitter. Why is that?
Well, I think it's such an amazing and powerful cultural force right now. In the last few years, Black Twitter has become an organizing force for protest. It has become a cultural hangout. It's a place where people watch an episode of Empire together. It has become a really powerful force in black culture.
We actually took some tweets from Black Twitter, compiled them, and recorded them. Let's take a listen.
At Ariva Martin, in case you missed it, we are not poor and dumb. An open letter to Mr. Trump by an educated Black woman. Hashtag Black Twitter.
At History Heroes, Blacks are challenged to buy from Black-owned businesses to close gap. Hashtag Black Business, hashtag Black Twitter.
At Black Girl Nerds, the injustice of a 1.9 million wrongful death settlement while officers responsible for the death of hashtag Sandra Bland go free is why we kneel.
At Speaking My Truth, for those who say we don't care about Black-on-Black crime, all of hashtag Black Twitter is discussing hashtag Rest in Peace Kendra, and we're all upset.
At RBelt84, if we get Nelly out of debt, hashtag Black Twitter is officially unstoppable. Hashtag get Nelly out of debt.
So, Michael, many people would think, well, this is not the kind of thing that this is beneath the Smithsonian's dignity, right? I mean, getting Nelly out of debt isn't what we usually see or talk about in the Smithsonian.
Well, the Smithsonian, there's nothing beneath the Smithsonian's dignity in that sense. We tell America's story, and Nelly is part of America's story. But to return to Black Twitter, the reason it's so powerful is because it's giving voice to the voiceless. The big part of the African-American story has been the inability to speak, the inability to be heard. And that's one of the most powerful things about Black Twitter today.
This issue is packed. There are so many different voices in here, it would be impossible for me even to list them off. But what were you hoping to accomplish with this issue?
Well, look, we had a very ambitious kind of goal with this issue, and that was to try to capture some of African-American life. Obviously, you couldn't do that in a single magazine issue. You couldn't do that in a single book. You couldn't do that in a library of books. And it's a real task to actually try to do it in a whole museum. But we tried to do our best with giving some taste of the range of African-American experience in America today and in the past. A big part of how we told that story is through the objects that are in the museum. So you have things that are just have such incredible power. You have shackles from the Middle Passage. You have Harriet Tubman's shawl, which was given to her by Queen Victoria.
Her shawl, yeah.
Her shawl.
Yeah.
And you have Nat Turner's Bible. One of the most poignant
Nat
objects.
Turner, who led an unsuccessful uprising.
Yes, mm-hmm. And who's the subject of a new and controversial movie, Birth of a Nation. You have Malcolm X's tape recorder, the tape recorder he used to tape and write his speeches. You have got one of the most poignant things is just a pair of shoes. It's actually a pair of heels that were used by one man who was walking in the Selma March. And if you look at those heels, it's just the shoe heels, and you see how worn down they are. There is such a power in them, and that it's really moving. And that's true of so many of the objects in this museum.
We only have about 30 seconds left here, Michael, but why did it take more than 100 years?
Hey, you'd have to ask a lot more people than me. You know, what's amazing is the landscape of this museum. I just want to talk a little bit about that. The museum is right next to the Washington Monument. The Capitol is down the way, down one end of the National Mall. Lincoln's Memorial is down the other, where the Great Emancipator, where Martin Luther King spoke. And there were slave pens out on the National Mall.
So we're going to get to Natasha Trethewey here. We'll bring Michael Caruso back. He's editor-in-chief of Smithsonian Magazine. It's been more than 50 years since a bomb exploded at the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama. The predominantly African-American congregation was preparing for Sunday service. Four girls, Addie Mae Collins, Denise McNair, Carol Robertson, and Cynthia Wesley, were killed in that explosion. Many other people were injured. The bombing served as the inspiration for Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Natasha Trethewey's poem, We Have Seen. It was featured in the September issue of Smithsonian Magazine. The former U.S. Poet Laureate is director of Emory University's Creative Writing Program.
Here's her reading of the poem.
The poem opens with an epigraph that reads, "Since the medieval period, the making of stained glass windows begins with the sketch of the chosen design, what was called the vidimus, from the Latin for we have seen. We have seen. View from the window of the 16th Street Baptist Church, September 15th, 1963. Because they must have wanted the symbol of their gospel visible to all, not only to those inside the sanctuary, and perhaps to show that the Savior watches over them both in and out of church, the congregation chose the painting not on canvas, but stained glass, Christ the Good Shepherd in a window facing east. In the aftermath, you could have seen from a hole in the window what a photographer captured, a sign on the building across the street, the word Liberty, its brutal irony in 1963, or the dark windows two stories above, the shattered body of a car, the street strewn with debris, the slick helmets of police catching the sun, how it all seems crowded together, a flat perspective. In the short depth of field, everything is compressed into the ruined tableau. If you could look beyond it, the palimpsest of wreckage, you might see what should have been, a street scene in which the parked fire truck is moving through the grainy light, headed elsewhere. The few onlookers framed in the windows, leaning out as if only to catch a breath of air. The men on the street below them, going about the business of the day as if it were any other. And in the middle ground, a man raising a camera to capture something we might have never had reason to see. Instead, his lens must find the wounded church, the mangled remains of windows, the twisted armatures, rosettes dangling from each gnarled grasp. And, as if to remind us of the angels, how they might walk unknown among us, as if to remind us of the martyred girls, like Addie Mae Collins, her face no longer a face her sister could recognize. Jesus, too, the window, his body left nearly intact, but faceless after the blast."
Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Natasha Trethewey reading her poem, We Have Seen. That poem is included in the September issue of Smithsonian Magazine. It's devoted to the National Museum of African American History and Culture. And you can also find that poem at our website, gpbnews.org. Just ahead, more on the opening of the Museum of African American History. First, though, Georgia Congressman John Lewis shares stories about the fight for civil rights. This is On Second Thought.
The dark brown shades of my skin only add color to my tears. Oh, oh, that splash against my hollow bones, that rocks my soul. Oh, 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 oh.
It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. We're talking this hour about the September issue of Smithsonian Magazine. It coincided with the opening of the new National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, D.C. Georgia Congressman John Lewis had pushed for this museum for years. His story as one of the original Freedom Riders is included in the magazine's Black in America issue. The Freedom Riders included more than a dozen civil rights activists who traveled to Mississippi and Alabama to fight segregation on transit systems. Congressman Lewis spoke with my colleague Adam Ragusea about the third and final installment of his graphic novel series, March, that deals with that history. And here's John Lewis describing its portrayal of his life.
It tells the story of my growing up in book one on a farm in rural Alabama, 50 miles from Montgomery, outside of a little place called Troy. And growing up there, I remember when I was 4 years old, my father had saved $300, and a man sold him 110 acres of land that my family is still on today. And if we would visit the little town of Troy, or visit Montgomery, or visit Tuskegee, I saw these signs that said white men, white women, colored women. And I would ask my mother, my father, my grandparents, my great-grandparents, why? They would say, that's the way it is. Don't get in the way. Don't get in trouble. But the words and the teaching of Dr. King and the action of Rosa Parks inspired me to find a way to get in trouble. And I got in what I call good trouble, necessary trouble. And I think as young people and people not so young read March, especially book one, and later book two, and book three, they will understand that I, for one, and many others, grew up and becoming committed to the way of peace, the way of love, the way of nonviolence.
Congressman, I think about you and the work that you did in Selma and elsewhere with Martin Luther King. I think about you often as I'm watching the Black Lives Matter movement play out. There was a moment when some Black Lives Matter protesters were blocking interstates in downtown Atlanta recently, and I was struck by how even people like Mayor Kasim Reed, who's very sympathetic to the movement, was saying, listen, guys, you know, I respect your right to protest. I hear where you're coming from. I share your anger about police brutality, particularly as it is directed disproportionately to African Americans. But please do not block public highways. I'm curious, Congressman Lewis, when you guys went over that bridge in Selma, did you have legal permission to block that road?
When we marched, attempted to march, rather, on March 7, 1965, from Selma to Montgomery. It was 600 of us. We were walking in twos. We never attempted to block the bridge or block the highway when we left the bridge. We were walking in orderly, peaceful, nonviolent fashion. It was like military discipline. We didn't try to disrupt or traffic. We were taught to act in an orderly, peaceful, nonviolent fashion. We studied, we prepared ourselves.
Yeah.
And we later got a court order from a federal judge after we were beaten and left bloody, and the judge granted us the permission to walk all the way from Selma to Montgomery. And because of the violence that happened in Selma on Bloody Sunday, President Lyndon Johnson ordered federal troops to protect us all the way from Selma to Montgomery.
Yeah.
People have a right to march in an orderly, peaceful, nonviolent fashion.
Well, when people criticize the Black Lives Matter movement, one of the things they say is that it's important to maintain law and order, rule of law in public spaces. Was that not the justification that was given for beating you and your friends on that bridge in Selma?
The governor of Alabama at the time, Governor George C. Wallace, the Alabama state troopers, and other law enforcement individuals said, in effect, that the march would not be allowed. They ordered us to disperse and return to our homes or to our church. But in America, as Dr. King was saying, you have a right to protest for what is right. You have a right to dissent. It's protected and guaranteed by the Constitution. Freedom of assembly. People all across America, and I believe the President of the United States and the federal courts, felt like our rights have been violated.
Congressman Lewis, I'm curious, when you look at Black Lives Matter today, what do you think about the movement from a strategic standpoint, from a tactical standpoint? How do you feel about the kinds of protests that the people who are protesting under this banner have mounted?
Well, I have met with some members of Black Lives Matter in Atlanta and other parts of America, and I said, whatever you do, do it in an orderly, peaceful, nonviolent fashion. And you try to appeal to the conscience of people. There's a lot of issues that they're confronting, but always respect the rights of others. When you see police officers, when I see police officers, and I tell Black Lives Matter people, respect officers. I said to them over and over again, I said, thank you for your service.
Yeah. Congressman Lewis, the world that we see in the graphic novels in the March series is one in which you are using these tactics that are now very familiar to us after having lived through the civil rights movement or seen it in the recent history, which is tactics like marches, tactics like sit-ins, civil disobedience. You brought one of those tactics back recently. You and your Democratic colleagues in the House staged a sit-in on the House floor demanding that the Republican leadership allow votes on gun control measures. Unfortunately, it looks as though that sit-in did not have quite the effect that you were hoping for. How do you look back on that experience?
I look back on it with a great deal of not just drama, but it's something that we had to do. We have been trying for many, many years since I've been in Congress to get to Congress to do something about the proliferation of guns in our society. We lost too many of our children, our brothers and sisters, our mothers and fathers, and it seemed like no one has listened. I felt in talking and meeting with some of my colleagues that we had to do something that was out of regular order.
Yeah.
And we spoke on the floor, and then we just took seats. And every place that I've traveled since then, all over America, people walk up and say, I'm a conservative, I'm a Republican, I'm a Democrat, but thank you for what you did. Airline pilots walk back when I'm riding the plane, the flight attendants will say thank you on the streets, they say thank you. We have to do something, and I think we will. This is not the end of what we tried to do. We out of the Congress until sometime in September. We will continue to find a way to push the issue, to dramatize the issue, to make it real that we have to put an end to gun violence. We're losing too many of our citizens. You know, I met President Kennedy in 1963 when I was 23. I met Martin Luther King Jr. in 1958 at the age of 18. I got to know Robert Kennedy. These three young men, three young leaders, killed by guns. And people like Mega Evers in Mississippi, and there have been many others of people in the movement that were shot and murdered. Every day in a city like Atlanta or Chicago, someone has been murdered, and we have to stop it.
Georgia Congressman John Lewis speaking with my colleague Adam Ragusa. Lewis details his experiences as one of the original Freedom Riders in the September issue of Smithsonian Magazine. While John Lewis stood up to the oppression in the Jim Crow South, others fled to different parts of the country. By 1970, around 6 million blacks had made that trip. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Isabel Wilkerson of Atlanta writes about this mass exodus in the September issue of Smithsonian, and I began by asking her where the Great Migration fits into the larger landscape of African-American history.
The time in which they were enslaved lasted for 246 years. That's 12 generations, a very, very, very long time. And then it was after the Civil War, it was replaced by a new form of servitude, which we often call Jim Crow, but it was actually a caste system in which everything that a person could do, black or white, was dependent upon what they looked like. And so that was a time of tremendous repression. It's hard to come up with any other word for how African Americans were being treated at that time in this beautiful region of the country known as the South. And what did the people do as a result of this? I mean, they were living in a world in which, believe it or not, in Alabama, it was against the law for a black person and a white person to merely play checkers together. It was against the law. You could go to jail if you were caught doing that. There was tremendous violence that was a part of the landscape that actually was a detriment to everybody, black and white. You know, when you had these spectacular, horrific cases of lynchings that occurred every 4 days somewhere in the South. So it was a brutal time for the region, just brutal. And what did these people do? These people, starting around World War I, began to flee this region in hopes of finding freedom. It essentially was a search for freedom and citizenship within their own country. So it was kind of a defection, you might say, from this caste system. And it's important to recognize that at the time that this began, 90% of all African Americans were living in the South. So African Americans throughout the country are actually a Southern people. They are Southern to their core. But by the time that this great migration ended in the 1970s, nearly half were living all over the rest of the country.
What struck me about your piece, it struck me even more than when I read your book, The Warmth of Other Suns, was the similarities in between the Great Migration and the refugee discussion that we're having today. Because to a certain extent, the African Americans were refugees. They had to, you include in your piece for the Smithsonian, an ad from the Urban League in Chicago saying, if you're a stranger, if you want a job, if you need a place to live, if you're having trouble, call us. It's almost as though the same sort of support they need when someone comes from another country and comes to a new place.
Yes, it's important to note, especially when you're looking at it from a Southern perspective, that when they arrived in these cities in the North and the Midwest and West, they were viewed as alien. They were viewed as other. They were Southern, and they had what Northerners considered to be accents, and they stood out, and people felt that they were. There was even a funny comment from someone in San Francisco who said that it'll take a little bit of time for them to get Americanized. You know, what does that mean? And so there was this idea that there was some refining that needed to happen to them as a result of their being quote unquote different. And so it's important to recognize that. I think the most important goal of much of what I write is to show how much we all have in common, that we all have so much more in common than we've been led to believe, that these are human reactions to human problems, to human challenges. And these people, as part of this great migration, were doing what people, you know, what immigrants around the world have done, what refugees around the world have done. And, you know, the issue for us as a species, as human beings, is to learn from what has happened before. You know, how can we learn from what others have experienced so that we don't keep making the same mistakes? One thing that's important to note, particularly when we're situated in the South, is to recognize that many of these, you know, these big headline-grabbing cases of police overreach and brutality that we're seeing in the headlines that we continue to see, most of them are happening in these northern and western cities that were the places of refuge for people who were the Southerners who left as part of the Great Migration. So this means that the North and the West and the Midwest have yet to truly address the challenges that face not just the South, but the entire country.
How do you view this opening of the African-American History Museum? I mean, that's what this is all about, that this museum that has been talked about and discussed and planned for at least 100 years is finally opening in our nation's capital. And yet it's still an African-American History Museum as opposed to incorporating that history in with the rest of American history. So I wonder how you take all this in.
Well, I think that, you know, there's a Museum of the American Indian, there's a Museum of Air and Space. This you know, deserves or needs its own platform, and I think that, or otherwise it subsumed by something larger. And I think that this is all of a piece. You know, there are many, many museums that are part of the Smithsonian, and they all come together. There's a Museum of the Holocaust. So there's a balancing of recognition that no one building can hold all of the history of the United States. States of America, and I think that this is appropriate. There's a deep and rich history. African American history is also a part of some of these other museums as well, and it all is a recognition of everybody has a role in the building of this country, and this is giving a sense of what the role of this group of people has been.
That's Atlanta journalist Isabel Wilkerson. I spoke to her back in September. The Pulitzer Prize-winning writer was featured in that month's issue of Smithsonian Magazine. She wrote an article about the Great Migration, and she's also author of the book, The Warmth of Other Suns, The Epic Story of America's Great Migration. You'll find links to her work on our website, gpbnews.org.
Lift every voice and sing till earth and heaven ring, ring with the harmonies of liberty.
So you get the green light to build a museum dedicated to African American history. Where do you start? That's ahead. This is On Second Thought.
Sing a song full of the faith that the dark past has taught us. Sing a song.
It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. There's a lot of attention given to the so-called alt-right movement. That's a new name for white supremacy. White supremacist Richard Spencer coined that term, alt-right, and he heads the National Policy Institute. That group has been labeled a hate group by the Southern Poverty Law Center. Tomorrow we'll talk about how the media should cover groups like that, and whether or not covering them at all humanizes hate groups. Call us and tell us what you think. It's 404-500-9457. That's how you can join this debate. And you can also post on Facebook or reach us on Twitter. The Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture opened in September. It's attracted visitors from all over the world. It took a long time for that museum to become a reality. And the creation of a museum is not always easy. Author Tanya Bolden documented the process in her book, How to Build a Museum. I spoke with her, Clark Atlanta University professor Daniel Black, and Smithsonian Magazine editor-in-chief Michael Caruso. I spoke with them in September, right before the museum opened, and I began by asking Michael why it took about a century to build this museum.
There was so much to overcome. The Smithsonian Museum is on the National Mall. The National Mall has been called America's front yard. On one end is the U.S. Capitol, which was built largely by slaves. On one part of it is the White House, which was built largely by slaves. On the other end is the Abraham Lincoln Memorial, the great emancipator, and also the site of the March on Washington and the I Have a Dream speech by Martin Luther King. In the middle, there were slave pens. Washington, D.C. was a slave market. In fact, the story of that is in 12 Years a Slave of Solomon Northrop took place, the Yellow House that he was housed in and imprisoned in, was right there on the National Mall, too. So it's an extraordinary thing. The one that I skipped is the Washington Monument. Of course, when Washington died, he had control of over 300 slaves himself. So it's an extraordinary place to put this museum, and there was so much to overcome, and it is so thrilling and amazing to be at this point where we are now.
Tanya, I wanted to play you this comment. This is from 1994. It's former North Carolina Senator Jesse Helms. He is explaining why he opposed funding for this museum back then.
Once we approve this museum, we will be called upon by other minority groups, and they will be justified in doing so, to provide museums for their particular groups.
To a certain extent, there, as Michael alluded to, there were specific challenges for this museum. What were they, Tanya? Mm-hmm.
Well, the fact that for decades, black lives and black achievements upon these shores didn't really matter to a lot of Americans outside of the black community.
So, Daniel, let me bring you then into this. Does that now mean that the opening of this museum is more than symbolic?
Yes, the opening of this museum is more than symbolic. The opening of this museum is the introduction of black worth and black achievement and black excellence into the very narrative and into the very fabric of what it means to be American. And the truth is that American history is not complete until this chapter of the story is written and read and told. Because black folks in America have been waiting for our turn to tell our own story and to tell that story as part of what it means to be on these American shores and to assure that everyone reads that chapter of our history, not just black people.
So I want to play.
Celeste, may I
go ahead, Tanya.
I'm sorry. The point, you know, of the museum and the point of a lot of the work that we do is that black history is everyone's history.
That's right.
Just as the Trail of Tears is my history, too.
That's right.
I'm an African-American. Just as the building of the Transcontinental Railroad and what was done to Irishmen and Chinese workers on it, that's my history, too. The Model T is my history, too. All the history is everybody's history.
So that kind of echoes this comment from Lonnie Bunch III. He's the director of the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture. Let's hear what he has to say.
I would argue that in many ways, African American history is the quintessential American story. That in some ways, when you look at core American values of resiliency, optimism, spirituality, where better to look than this community? Almost any moment where you see an expansion of liberty or a redefinition of citizenship, you see the African American experience as part of it. So in many ways, I don't see this as a separate story. I see this as just another way to understand America, but through an African American lens.
So, yeah, Michael, why then have a separate museum rather than incorporating all of these artifacts and all of this history into an American history museum?
Well, we have one of those, too. In fact, it's right next door. And the real question that has come up a lot is, what do you put in each museum? The answer is there are too many stories to tell for one museum. There's too many stories to tell for the Smithsonian now has 19 museums. And frankly, there's too many stories for us to tell in even those 19 museums. Everybody deserves to have their story told. And the stories that are within this museum are so powerful, so poignant, and so important to everybody in America that they needed their own building.
Tanya, where did all of these tens of thousands of objects come from?
Well, they came from, they made requests. They were very bold in asking people to make donations, individuals and institutions. They acquired some objects at auction. And there was the Save Our African American Treasures workshop held in about a dozen cities around the country where people were invited to bring up to, I think, three items, their family treasures, heirlooms, and have them reviewed and possibly dated, and most importantly, you know, advised on how to preserve them. And inevitably, some of the people ended up wanting to donate those items to the museum.
Daniel, I want to go back to this question of why we need this separate museum. And this is Jonetta Cole. She is the director of the Smithsonian National Museum of African Art.
So many said, why do we need a special place to tell those stories when there isn't an acknowledgement of a people's history and their culture? There's no acknowledgement of those people.
Is there a risk, Daniel, when you have so many of these objects separate, that some Americans will just choose to avoid that museum altogether?
There is that risk, but there's also the invitation for people to become more enlightened, to become more excellent. And we have to be honest about this in one way. There has always been a Museum of American History. If that museum cared enough, if that museum was interested enough, if we as Americans were interested enough in telling all the stories of all the Americans, one museum really would do. But the problem has been historically that we have not cared enough. We have not, as a people, we've not raised our children, all of us, to believe that every life and every life's narrative must be told and must be heard. And so until we get to that place, we have to have these separate museums. And the point of the separate museums is to assure that no one is left out, to assure that no voice is silenced. But hopefully the day will come where everyone will get clear that every museum is our inheritance and every child is absolutely required to know every story.
We'd love to hear from all of you out there listening. What parts of African-American history would you want to see featured? It opens this weekend. Maybe there's already an exhibit on the thing you want to see. You can tweet us at OST Talk or join our conversation on Facebook. My guests are author Tanya Bolden, who wrote How to Build a Museum, Clark Atlanta professor Daniel Black, and Smithsonian Magazine editor Michael Caruso. We sent our producers out on the streets of Atlanta to ask about the new African-American Museum, and here are a few responses.
My name is Kwomika. I'm from the west side of Atlanta. I think it's important that they have an African American museum for the younger generation that coming up could be able to learn more about their history.
My name is Marissa, and I'm from Peoria, Illinois. I think especially with all the controversy going on in America or the United States, I think it's really important that we add that value, that they are important and they matter just as much.
Tanya, what was the philosophy in the creation of this museum? Who was their target demographic?
I think it's for everyone, for children, for adults. It really is. The museum welcomes the world.
What do you mean by that?
Well, it's saying, welcome, come in. There's a symbolic sort of porch thing in part of the design. It's saying, come and learn, come and be inspired, because the museum, yes, they'll cover the brutality, it will cover the brutalities, the horrors, the ordeals, and all that. But there'll also be jubilees and talk about the striving and the overcoming and the enormous strides people of African descent made in this country against, you know, impossible odds.
So how did you deal with that, Michael, the balancing of joy with an obviously story which is so often tragic?
Yeah, that was really important to us, and I think it's important to the museum, too. The museum is actually structured very interestingly. There's five stories that are below ground, and as you go down into those stories, you see a lot of dark stories that are told. But as you come up through the rest of the museum, you'll see the light, basically. You'll see stories, amazing, inspiring stories of achievement in the arts, in sports, in the military, all over, basically, American life. And that's the great experience that African Americans have had and that everybody needs to learn from. We tried to do the same thing in the issue of Smithsonian Magazine, knowing that there's a lot of people that won't get to visit Washington, D.C. soon, and we wanted to give them a taste of what the museum was like and what African American life is like today for those who don't know it as well or don't know parts of it as well. And so we invite you to read the magazine and get a taste of what's in the museum.
Daniel.
And there's a design too, Celeste.
Yeah.
I mean, the three-tier Urban art inspired Corona, which the architectural team, for them, it represents celebration and praise.
Yeah. So, you know, obviously there's going to be a lot of sorrow in that museum, but try to balance it with joy. So Daniel, what parts of African American history did you think were the most important at the moment that they opened? Because, you know, they'll be rotating the exhibits. So what were the stories that had to be in there now?
I think one of the stories that absolutely had to be in there now is the story of our coming to this land, the notion of how we arrived. That moment.
And how early that was.
That's right. Which was really before America was America.
Yeah, before right? The settlers landed at Plymouth Rock.
Absolutely. That moment known as the Middle Passage, or what we call the Ma'afa, the great tragedy, the great destruction of black lives across the Atlantic Ocean to this place. That story had to be told because the number of lives lost, the amount of culture destroyed, and the amount of culture retained, quite frankly, is something I think the world has never known. And in many instances, it's something that people simply don't know. You know, we've been told that Africans were brought on slave ships. We knew that. But the question of exactly who was brought, from where were they brought, what were their dreams, what were their hopes, these were human beings. They weren't simply cargo. These were human beings who had stories and who had histories. And I think telling that story helps also people in this land, especially African Americans, be clear and be proud proud of the African heritage from whence they come, so that one is not believing this notion that their history only starts during slavery. No, that's simply the bridge that brings one from Africa to America, but it connects to a larger narrative that I think is one of the most fascinating stories ever been told.
And that is the subject of your book, The Coming.
That's
sorry,
right.
Tanya, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, you know, just picking up on his excellent point is that we have to stop and think that if we were a nothing people, people like me wouldn't be here.
That's right.
So whatever I've achieved, the 30-something books I've done, my degrees and all that, that says less about me and more about the people whence I come.
Yes.
Michael, to what extent is the museum and then the issue of your magazine speaking to not just adults, but young people, people still in grade school?
Well, I think that's a really important aspect of it. Obviously, we want to educate everybody. And hey, there are plenty of adults who need education, too, especially on subjects like this. But of course, we want to speak to young people, too. A lot of American history is lost to us on a regular basis, on an almost annual basis. And so it's really important that kids learn what their history is, because that's what's in their DNA. That's what is in our culture. And if you're going to operate well, you have to operate in an informed way. So that's a big part of our mission.
Tanya, how much consideration went into the number of young people that would be walking through and might be upset by some of the exhibits in the museum?
Well, I can't speak for the curators, but I think that children are more resilient than we realize. And I know people often say it's going to disturb them. And I say they ought to be disturbed, because being disturbed is a door to enlightenment. I recall I was 12, 13 when by accident I stumbled upon a photograph of Emmett Till and his casket. And I was disturbed, very disturbed. And my parents had to sit down.
Emmett Till was the young man who was
to me.
Murdered because he allegedly smiled or made inappropriate.
And so I think children, when I work with kids in school and we talk about some of the tough issues, I put it in perspective and talk about, look at all the global horrors and how would you feel if the, because that's the only way to become empathetic.
Daniel, how important...
Just to be disturbed.
I wonder for you, as a professor especially, how important this museum is and how much of this history do students who come to Clark Atlanta know?
Well, I think that's really the critical question, and that is, what gap does this history fill in terms of the public consciousness of who we are as African people in this country? And this museum, quite frankly, I feel like it would be the educational lifeblood of the nation. Black kids, white kids, Native American kids, Asian kids, most kids are very, very, very ill-informed about African history, African American history in this country. It is incorrect to believe that because a child is black, they automatically know black history. That certainly is not true. We have awesome, 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 brilliant, amazing young people who come to Clark Atlanta University. What's also true is their knowledge of African American history is often very very lacking, quite frankly. And what I've loved teaching African American history is the way in which our young people at Clark Atlanta University are inspired and are thrilled and are moved by learning about their own culture, because, of course, what they're really doing is constructing their own identity. And I think that's what this museum does on a national level. It allows African descended people in America to construct an identity they're proud of and that they can put on the national scene without having their heads bowed.
Clark Atlanta University Professor Daniel Black, Tanya Bolden, who's author of the book How to Build a Museum. I also spoke with Smithsonian Magazine Editor-in-Chief Michael Caruso. That conversation happened in September. That month's issue of Smithsonian Magazine was called Black in America. It coincided with the opening of the National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, D.C. And that's our show for today, but we would love to hear from you. If you were going to create one, what kind of museum would you create? You can leave us a message at 404-500-9457. You can also email us at onsecondthought@gpb.org. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.